This is the Live Your Edge Podcast, Episode 5. This is your host, Gilbert Joa. Today I'll be talking with my guest, Eric Shim, on his journey from New York to Vietnam and how he started a company and lived abroad, and some tips for those that are thinking about making the jump. Hello, this is Gilbert. Welcome to the podcast. Let's get started with our guest interview with Eric Shim. Hello, everyone. Today we are with Eric Shim, who is a digital nomad entrepreneur. He started his company 2 years ago. It's a digital explainer video agency. And he was originally from New York, but has now relocated to Vietnam. I'll just let Eric share with you quickly about his background and what he's been working on so far. Eric?
Hey, Gilbert. Yes, so thanks so much for having me on today. I'm really excited to share my experiences with your audience. As you mentioned, I used to work and live over in New York City, and I think you mentioned that you're over in New York right now as well. So I was kind of like you. I was working in a B2B software sales role, and I spent some time at startups as well as some larger companies, mainly servicing like financial services type of customers and clients. And kind of was getting really bored of it, and decided I just wanted to do my own thing. And I've always had an itch to be an entrepreneur, but just didn't know kind of what to do. And, tried out a bunch of different things. Some stuff didn't work out. And, I always had that, desire to kind of see the world as well. Living in New York, what you realize is that since it's a city that's kind of like a central hub for everybody, you have friends that come from all different parts of the country, California, like Chicago, and all different parts of the world even, right? You kind of feel like, being somebody, and I was born in New York, and I lived in New Jersey, and I went to school in Boston. So like I basically spent my whole life in like a 3 or 4 hour radius. You almost feel like the guy that like left home, right? So I was kind of getting to that sort of place in my life where I was like, hey, I kind of want to explore a little bit and see what's out there. But at the same time, all the job opportunities were in, New York City where I was at. So decided, I'm going to kind of just go all in, started my own business, and, fortunately worked out. What I do is I create animated explainer and marketing videos for different businesses. And mainly right now, I've been focusing a lot on two types of clientele. One are startups, so mainly tech startups. And the second type of clientele is like blockchain companies, the cryptocurrencies. Fortunately, it's gotten to the point where it's, making me pretty decent income. And, I've been able to travel to different parts of the world. I think I've been to about 7 or 8 different countries in the past year and a half. And currently, I hate winter, so I've kind of settled, down a little bit in Southeast Asia. And, I've been enjoying life ever since.
So what was the biggest, because being from New York myself, many of the stuff that we need or we are used to are all around us. We don't really need to go anywhere else. And most of my peers and friends haven't even left a 15-mile radius from their birthplace. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you could resonate with this as well. So what was the biggest challenge leaving New York, leaving what people would say one of the most metropolitan cities in the world, and going somewhere, say, you spend a lot of time in Asia. So other than being a challenge, how big of a change was that for you?
Sure. So, I think the biggest thing that, the biggest challenge I had, and not necessarily a challenge, but more so just, the thing that I feel like I left back the most is simply just, family and friends. Other than that, I actually enjoy life a lot more outside of New York, to be honest with you. I think New York City is kind of like a place where you either love it or hate it. I didn't necessarily hate it, but, as you already know, things are obscenely expensive over there. Everything's really small. There's always a line whenever you go to places. Winters get really cold and summers get super humid. I really don't like any of the stuff I listed. I hate winters. I hate humidity. So, you know, other than that, it's been actually quite easy to adjust, even though I'm in a different place. I tend to aim to stay in places that where English is pretty prevalent, and, you know, I'm not having to, you know, learn a different language or anything like that. So, you know, it hasn't been that difficult of a transition. I guess if you had to point something out, specifically, this would be just business related, is the time zones have been tough, because the vast majority of my clientele are in the United States, and, you know, with some of them in Europe, but even then, you know, the time zones are a bit more different. So that, more than anything, has been the biggest challenge, I would say.
Because I've never been to Vietnam before, and I plan on going next year. I'm not so familiar with the environment there. So maybe you could share a bit with our audience more about, because I'm sure if they've never been, say, Asia, they might think that there wouldn't be a huge English speaking population. But from my experience living in Hong Kong for 7 years, is actually there's a lot of English speakers, and even locals, most of them speak English. So what has your experience been like in Vietnam?
So, I mean, wherever you go, I would say, well, not wherever, but a lot of places you go, you'll notice that there are certain areas of different cities that are predominantly places where, like, you know, digital nomads or like expats or, you know, people from other countries live. So kind of like, you know, if you go into New York City, for example, you go to like Flushing and then it's all like the Asian people. You go to Brooklyn and that's where like all the, you know, like the Russian people and the Jewish people live. So everyone kind of migrates to their own almost like pockets within different places, and it's no different, you know, overseas. So what you'll see is if you go to like Vietnam, for example, I'm in Saigon right now. There are certain areas within the city where like all the English speaking folk, you know, it doesn't really matter what country they're from, but like people who just speak English as their main language or are better in English than, you know, than their Vietnamese skills, I guess, they tend to congregate and live in certain areas. You know, if that's kind of like something that's holding somebody back, like, oh, I don't think I'll be able to learn a language, you won't need to actually, for the most part, unless you're going somewhere like super rural or, you know, somewhere not like really metropolitan, then you might struggle a little bit. But as long as you're going to, you know, a sizable city, you shouldn't have a problem with it.
Yeah, because the term digital nomad's been getting a lot more popular these days. And I see that some of my friends who have been asking me, you know, what is it like to just be on the road and traveling around and not having a, like, some place where you're staying for long term? It's a lot of changes, always constantly different things happening. And also, on a side note, I think food and culture is something that that may concern people, right, when it comes to making a big move. But I'm familiar that I heard from a friend that once they had the pho in Vietnam and they came back to New York, it was never the same anymore, right?
Yeah, the places where they originate from. But, you know, personally, I eat anything, right? So as long as it's not something like super weird, I tend to be fairly lax about that kind of stuff. So, you know, personally, I haven't had any issues adjusting. And fortunately enough, you know, just if you live in, you know, one of those kind of digital nomad areas or like an expat area, you'll get all your Western options there. And you know, it may not be as tasty as it is back home, but, you know, if you have like a craving for pizza or whatever, you know, it really won't be a problem finding anything like that.
Yeah. And I actually try to stay away from having the Western options when I'm overseas, because I think one of the reasons being in that country in the first place is to experience a different culture, different food. But of course, like you mentioned, there's some weird food out there. And what is the strangest food you ever tried?
Let me think. I haven't tried like that many weird things. You know, I kind of try to stay pretty. I mean, I'm open to a lot of different types of stuff, like how they cook it. But you know, I'm not gonna. I'm very sensitive to eating, like, you know, things that I, like animals and stuff that you wouldn't normally find in places or like eat in different places. So, you know, I don't know. I would say like the most exotic thing I've had was actually in Manhattan when I had like the fertilized like duck eggs.
Oh.
I think, that was probably, you know, the oddest thing, the most like adventurous thing I've had. But that was, you know, just back home.
So you're afraid of upset stomach, right?
Yeah, and I also just like, I don't know, I think about what I'm eating all the time. It's like, you know, like a creepy crawly, like, creature.
Oh
So
man.
I tend to not eat that kind of stuff. But I haven't seen that many weird things I eat
I think
since
there's a
I've been.
lot in China. There's a lot. I've seen those little bugs. Like they look like bugs. I don't know if bugs, but I see them people eating it, and I'm like, I mean, it's not for everyone. The worst thing I've tried, well, not it wasn't the worst. It actually tastes good. It's quite exotic. Was snake. I was eating a snake in Hong Kong, and it tastes like chicken actually. It's
Oh,
quite interesting. But yeah, I can totally understand that. But some people are very adventurous with the food, right? I tend to stay on the safe side, and yeah, and for me, actually, the food was always a concern when I go to any new country because I don't eat everything. I'm actually quite a picky eater, and sometimes that doesn't work.
I'm like not picky in the sense that like as long as it's part of the 95% of the things I would eat, I'm not going to say, oh, I want this instead of that all the time. But if it's like part of the 5% of stuff I won't eat, I'm really probably not never going to eat that.
No scorpions for me. I'm already. So after moving to Vietnam, you spent 2 years there. In terms of
Less than 2 years.
less than 2 years.
I left the US and originally went to Thailand for about 6 months.
Oh wow. Which part of Thailand?
In Chiang Mai.
Chiang Mai. I think that was one of the destinations I had for next year. Spend like, a month, 2 months there. And do you think that's a lot or enough or?
Month, 2 months, it should still be fun. I was just kind of getting bored after. I was there for, I think about 6 months, maybe. I forget exactly, but it's a small, well, it's not small. There's like, it's a big landmass, I think, but like, it's a small city, population-wise. And so I kind of got bored of it a little bit. I would say if you're, starting off your digital nomad journey, it's a very common place where a lot of people start off. It almost feels like a college campus in a sense, because everyone there is, for the most part, a lot of the nomads you see, that's their first stop. So everyone's looking to make friends, kind of like freshman year when you go into school. And because it's such a small community, you tend to see like the same people over and over again in a lot of places. So it's a good place, I think, to get your feet wet before you go to other places.
And I see it's sort of like everyone is in transition or in sort of like let's say transient. Everyone is staying for a few months, and then after a few months, a new group of people are coming into town, and then.
It's definitely like that, more so in Chiang Mai than here. So it's funny you say that because, when I was there, my friends and I used to joke like we should have like a community-wide Excel spreadsheet where everyone puts like their expiration date, which means basically like when they're leaving. So like who you should actually invest time to become friends with and who's like not
Oh,
worth it. So if you're like
wow.
leaving in a week, then it's like, there's no point in really getting to know this person. But if you're there for like 3 months, maybe we should grab a beer sometime because it is very transient.
I mean, I think the beauty of it is, especially a place like Chiang Mai, for all the in and out. I mean, the drawback, of course, is you don't have enough time to really build a very deep friendships with people. But at the same time, you end up having friends that are all over the world.
It's definitely, you're right. You don't really get to develop like really intimate friendships with people because again, everyone's just leaving. It's almost like every week somebody leaves, right? So and then eventually it's your turn to leave too. But you do, build out a network. But what you'll also find is that you're not like, meeting friends all the time. Once you have like your set of friends, you tend to like stick with that group because it's just easier and more convenient. And so but you're not gonna have like this huge network of people from all over the world. You're gonna have like, friends that you tend to hang out with that are, like-minded like you. And so I mean it's the good thing about it, I would say, is just it's easy to make friends there socially. Not necessarily like you're getting, this huge new network that you weren't exposed to before, because that I don't think it would necessarily be the case.
It seems like everyone there is on a similar journey. Maybe they've just started their online business, or they are a freelancer, or they have any other sort of ventures going on, and everyone's just trying to help each other out. I think it's the community is actually quite everyone is so helpful and open-minded to that.
I would say, not to sound like a pessimist, but that's kind of how things are portrayed. If you watch like, the YouTube videos and stuff like that. But I don't think it's necessarily the best place if you want to like network for business. If you're starting out and you want like advice and stuff and like people to teach you, you're much better off like buying a course and like doing it on your own, actually paying for somebody to actually guide you, right? If you go to a place like Chiang Mai, you'll see that everyone's kind of in the same place for the most part, because everyone's kind of starting off, you know? That's their first place. They're, you know, a lot of people are in the same mentality. You know, I quit my job, I want to travel the world, and Chiang Mai is kind of the most popular destination for everyone to start off. You'll go there, you'll think that, oh, you know, all these people are going to be teaching me and stuff. And if that's the mentality that you're going there with, you're going to be disappointed. If your mentality is, you know, I'm going to succeed no matter what, I'm going to invest in myself. And, you know, if somebody kind of helps me along the line, that's great. But you don't expect that. That's not your expectation. You go in expecting that you're going to have to do everything on your own. But, you know, you're open to making new friends and developing a network and all that kind of stuff. That you can have great. Oh. So, yeah, that's kind of my advice. Like, you watch all these YouTube videos and stuff and people travel blogging, it doesn't paint the exact right picture in terms of like the business thing. You know, a lot of people there are just learning, I would say. And eventually they do, some of them do well, but it's not because like they have like all these mentors and stuff helping them. So business wise, it's not the place to go if you're looking for mentorship. If you're looking for people to help you along the way, the only surefire method to do that is to pay somebody, right? Because time is valuable for everybody, especially if it's somebody that's doing well. Unless it's like a close personal friend that is just willing to help you out, you're not going to be able to travel to some foreign country and out of the blue, some stranger is going to help you and build their business, because there's no reason for them to do that. You know what I mean? So I think people have to have realistic expectations when they go to places and not just trust what people say on like YouTube channels and stuff, because those people, you got to think about their incentive. Their incentive is to make entertaining content and sell the dream so that they get subscribers and people that watch. Because if it's like just like a, you know, very doom and gloom, not doom and gloom, but if it's a super like practical, like this is actually how it is type of video, no one's really going to watch. It's not really entertaining. You know, if you're looking to, you know, get information and stuff like that about going to different places, you know, that's fine, but just have realistic expectations.
I believe it's really important not to get the wrong expectation, like you said, of what it's like to just be overseas, especially say in a transient environment like Chiang Mai. And just know that a lot of times that if you want to find a mentor or learn, you might have to pay for courses and pay for coaches. And like myself, I have to pay for the coaches on my business. And I found out that while speaking with my coach, he told me that, just a side note about advice, typically when people have to pay for advice rather than get free advice, it makes a huge difference in the results that are able to be achieved. I think that a lot more commitment goes into paying someone for the advice, don't you think?
You can't expect somebody to invest in you if you are not willing to invest in yourself. So I actually have people, you know, who saw my Facebook profile and are in like my you know, Facebook group, they PM me and say, oh, can I ask some of your time? I want to ask you some questions. And I tell them, hey, listen, I'm happy to do that, but I do charge an hourly rate for consulting. And then they say, you know, they get like, oh, no, I'm hoping you can help me for free. But, you know, how can you expect somebody to help you, you know, invest their time in you if you're not willing to invest in yourself, right? You know, even like, it's not necessarily just a monetary thing. It's like, you're kind of telling yourself like, hey, I'm taking this serious, gonna commit to this by, you know, it's kind of like you're paying your way in to pay, you know, to make that commitment in a sense as well. And that not only helps you, because you're kind of, you know, that's something that you're committing to with your own dollars, but also just the person that's helping you. If it's some random person that's gonna offer you free advice, how good can it really be? You gotta kind of ask yourself the question. Probably not that great, right? So but at the same time, if you're paying somebody that is already successful in what they're doing, and they're now obligated, it's their duty to, because they've taken your money to help you in any way possible, because you've hired them to do that. So, you know, you do get a much better result now.
That's correct. And one of the things that you do is you teach people how they can create leads, right, with LinkedIn, particularly in the B2B space. Is that correct?
Yeah, so correct. So I do that in a couple of different ways. So I have a Facebook group, which it's completely free. And that's where I used to kind of just build my community for personal branding and stuff like that. Again, I'm going to be completely straightforward with you. It's not out of the goodness of my heart because I want to share all this info, right? I have an end goal in mind, which is to build my personal brand, which will help me grow other stuff down the line. But as a result of that, the benefit that the people in my group get is that they get free information. They get access to me via the group. You know, I don't really like it when people PM me all the time and try to get like private consulting. That's something that I tend to not be too responsive to. But if people ask me questions and stuff within the group, I'll happily comment and all that kind of stuff. You know, as long as it's benefiting multiple people, not just one person. So that's completely free, you know, and people, you know, your listeners can feel free to join in. It's called Online Freedom Entrepreneurs. I mean, sorry, Online Business Secrets. I had to change the name recently. Also, what I do is I have like a small group coaching as well. And that's a paid group. And, you know, I help them get basically started from scratch and, you know, build their own online businesses that they can basically, you know, run from anywhere. Doing pretty well. One of my students had like 7 new clients in like 2 weeks or something like that, all paying him, you know, a 4-figure sum for each of his sales. So, you know, it's a thing that anyone can do. It's just that they just need basically the right guidance to be able to do it.
Exactly. It'd be great if you can share a bit about the journey for you starting out your company while, again, you were overseas and not in your home country. What was the journey like for you?
Sure. So I actually started the company while I was still working full-time in Manhattan. So my advice is like, and this is just personal advice. Some people may disagree. Again, I this is the route that I took and it worked out. Don't quit your job until you have, you know, a proof of concept. So let's say for my business, right? If I made sure that I had clients coming in, that I was making sales before I kind of went all in and quit my job and, you know, depended on this business for all my income. And that has, I think, really helped with my success. The reason is that if you quit your job too early, you know, you're getting a steady paycheck and all of a sudden that money's not there anymore, right? Unless you have a lot of money saved up, you're going to be too pressured to make sales ASAP, which is good and bad. But that, you know, assuming that things don't take off as planned right off the bat, you're going to be way too stressed out and your chances are you're going to end up failing and going back to your job. Because you got to understand you're not only paying for your living expenses, but you're also paying for business expenses. And that stuff can all add up. So what I did was, you know, I was still working my 9-to-5 and nights and weekends I would, you know, instead of like going hanging out with my friends, I would go to like a coffee shop, work on building the business up for whatever tasks it may be, you know, prospecting, getting projects done and all that kind of stuff. Until I got to a point where I was comfortable enough where I had my proof of concept where like I know that this is going to be sustainable. I know that I have a service that people want and I have money coming in from the business where I felt comfortable enough. So, you know, what I would do is like during lunch breaks, I would hide in like a conference room, take sales calls from my other business on my cell phone and like, you know, go to my other, like my business's email from my work computers. And, you know, like I had contractors doing like the video work. And so I like keep in touch with them over that. And it was like, you know, it took a lot of sneaking around, but yeah, that's basically kind of how I got my start.
Yeah. Cause I think some people would feel, oh, I got to do it now. And then they just jump in without a safety cushion and they underestimate how much time it actually takes to get on their feet with the business. And actually, this is one of the mistakes that I made. Well, I made a few. One of them was waiting too long to jump. And the other one was I jumped, but then I underestimated how much time it took to build out the business. But luckily, I was able to manage that part. But I know that a lot of people, if they start, if it doesn't happen in a month, if they don't see any results after 2 months, 3 months, then very likely they will just say, okay, you know what, this is not for me. And of course they get pressure from outside environments, especially once the money starts to.
Exactly. And so I think a good way to do it, the way I did it was like, I was working my full-time job and I gave myself a deadline. And I said, if this is what I really want to do, if I want to run my own business and I want to, you know, travel, and if this is a real goal I have, kind of like a happy medium between like just quitting and going all in, or just like not taking any action and waiting too long to quit. So what I did was, while I was still working my job, I gave myself a deadline. I said, this is the date where I'm going to be running this business full time. I'm going to have my clients, and I'm going to quit my job by this date, and I'm going to leave. Right. And then I worked toward that goal. I basically kind of was committed to working, you know, this company succeeding as if I quit my job, but I still didn't have that financial pressure. Right. Because if you quit your job, you have no money coming. It's not like if you get fired or you have like a severance. So you have some leeway. So I think for starting a business, getting fired is like the best thing, if that's what you really want. But unfortunately for me, I resigned. I didn't get fired. So so you don't have money coming in, but you still have that goal in mind. Like, this is my you know, deadline. If I'm not doing it by this time, then, you know, I got to rethink everything and, you know, start from scratch almost, in a sense. So I thought that was, you know, the most practical way, because a lot of people may, again, kind of like you alluded to, you may not have the right idea of like when you should quit and go all in, because eventually you do have to go all in. You can't just like work your business as a side thing forever. You may get to a point where, you know, you're just taking too long to go all in, and that's obviously not a good thing as well. You know, I think what I did was it gave me like a good, it prevented me from being too stressed out, and at the same time, it gave me like enough of the good pressure that I needed to make sure things are, you know, progressing.
So speaking of taking too long to go in, just a quick story was, 2 years ago, I actually told myself that I would, 2016, I told myself at the end of the year, end of 2016, I would quit my job and be going full-time into my business. What ended up happening was I did that in 2018, the beginning of 2018. In between, I end up taking another job, also in B2B, because I kind of talked my way out of it. I said, you know what, I don't have enough experience, I don't have enough resources. So I did go and take another job. But my question is, how long were you in sort of side hustle mode, where you're spending weekends, you're spending lunch breaks and evenings working on your side business before you decided to go and take it full time?
Sure. So I'll answer your question in like two parts. You know, for my animated video production company, it was about a month and a half to 2 months of working as a side hustle, getting enough clients to, you know, have a proof of concept, having enough money coming in before I decide to go in full time. But prior to that, I tried out a number of different businesses that didn't go so well. The reason for that was, it was pretty obvious. It's because like I was getting into like what was hot at the moment. So, you know, like how in stocks you're supposed to buy low and sell high. Types of online businesses, they kind of have a thing too, where like something gets really hot and then everybody tries to jump in on it, and then it oversaturates the market. I tried stuff like Amazon, drop shipping, like that kind of stuff prior to starting my video business. And those were like the hot things at the moment. Everybody was getting into it. Unfortunately, because it was so saturated because of all the people getting into it, I didn't, you know, succeed in those. It didn't work out for me. I say, like, if you count that stuff as well, I would say it would be almost a year of me, you know, kind of working, you know, on the side in addition to my full-time job. But if you're looking for like the actual business that succeeded, it was like a month and a half.
By 2 months, can also, I mean, for you, it took 2 months, but also to make sure that we don't give out a false expectation, is that it varies quite a bit, especially if it's a side hustle. There is only so much time that you have, free time you have that can be devoted to it. And I've always sort of advocated, because a few years ago, I started a company that didn't work out. We had a few partners that were part-time. The main reason that it didn't work out was everyone was part-time. There was no real commitment towards it. I think that we need to strike a balance. And also the timing might even take 2 years.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. It really depends on, you know, number one, the type of business that you're running, because some businesses are much easier to take off than others, right? And it also depends on, you know, there's a number of different factors. If you're kind of going half speed and working only part-time as a side hustle, obviously you're going to be taking longer, right? But if you go like balls to the wall, you know, even if you're working as a side hustle, like you're, you know, giving all you got, things can progress more quickly. So, you know, it's going to be a case by case basis, depending on, you know, what business that you're trying to run, how comfortable you are to be able to quit, right? So for example, my business, I already had like at least like 5 clients before I said, all right, you know, I'm done. I'm going, this thing's working. I'm going into it full time. But, you know, there may be other businesses where maybe the margins are not as good, where you need like, you know, 100 clients before you can, you know, or 100 customers or something before you can feel comfortable enough to quit, right? So there's a lot of different factors that come into play. But what I teach my students to do at least is work on businesses where the margins are fairly decent and it's easier to get clients. And I tend to think that offering like a B2B service is kind of the way to go. And those you usually are able to scale up to a point where you're at least able to sustain yourself from the business a lot more quickly than, let's say, you know, just selling like consumer products or something like that.
In terms of sustaining, let's say that someone listening to this, they're working at a job right now and they're planning on leaving. They got their idea ready. They're working on it. They spent some time part-time working on it. How much, well, I know this is very subjective, but how much do you think, or in your experience, expense-wise, that you would need to keep saved up, like to sustain one, your rent, paying the bills, food, living in Southeast Asia?
I mean, that's a very difficult question.
Yeah.
Because everyone's circumstances are different, right?
Yeah.
I was married. I didn't have kids, you know, so I'm basically just responsible for taking care of myself financially, right? So it's a lot easier for a person in like my position to be able to say that, you know, I only need this much saved up. Whereas if you have like family to take care of, you have a husband, a wife, maybe you're even taking care of like your parents and your
winner, kid.
It's going to be a lot different, you know? Also would depend on like where you are in the world. One of the reasons that I left New York was it was super expensive. I've been, you know, living fairly comfortably. You're going to need a lot more money. And if you're living in somewhere like, one of the reasons I left New York was because Chiang Mai, Thailand was a lot cheaper. And that's one of the benefits of building a business there is because you don't have to worry about the stress of like expenses. So, you know, if you're living somewhere like there, you could have a lot less saved up, you know. I had more than enough to sustain myself for like, you know, let's say things didn't go well. I could live there for like years at that time. But at the same time, you don't want that. You know, you want to be making money. But anyway, I guess I tried. But anyway, if you're living somewhere like there, you could get away with not having as much money saved up. You know, so it's really depending on your own circumstances. But I would say if I had to give an overarching figure, my recommendation would be 6 months. All your living expenses should be taken care of, you know, in the bank account. So if you're a single person, it's going to be less. If you have a family, it's going to be more. If you're in like an expensive city, it's going to be more. So it'll kind of depend on your own individual circumstances. I would say 6 months to be comfortable plus whatever business expenses you are going to incur. Cause, that's kind of like a whole separate thing as well. Cause, if you have employees, you know, that's going to cost money. The way I did it was I work with only contractors and I may have like, you know, virtual assistants helping out with certain tasks, but they're not employees. So I pay them, you know, if they stop work, I don't owe them like severance or anything like that. It's basically I pay them by the hour. So it's, you know, it really depends on your own, like a situation, but that would be my recommendation.
Yeah. And speaking of contractors and I would say remote gig workers or virtual assistants, I'm sure that many people have this question of who should they or how many, like what tasks should be sort of outsourced. And I'm sure you have a virtual assistant or several virtual assistants helping you out with your work right now. Is that correct?
I'll answer the second question first. So now I don't have a virtual assistant. I have like a in-person assistant.
Okay.
Because it's a lot more easy to communicate that way in person. So I can say, hey, can you do this? And whatnot. So yes, I do, but it's now I have like a full-time in-person assistant who helps me out with a lot of tasks. But in terms of like what do you exactly need, you kind of have to think of it in a different way. You can't start off with what virtual assistants should I need and then work towards the result. The proper way to think about it is, what is the result I'm trying to get to, and what do I need to outsource to get to that result, right? So if you think of it in the other way, like, okay, I need somebody to do my lead gen, I need somebody to do like my website, I need somebody to do my SEO, then you'll have a stable of assistant. But what you'll realize is, and this is a mistake I made at the beginning, I hired way too many people and I didn't need most of the stuff. It was kind of overkill, and what ends up happening is you get super confused as well, and it's just too many moving parts for you to be able to handle. What's the reason for getting the virtual assistant? Don't justify the actual work because you have the assistant. Justify getting the assistant with the actual work you're doing, right? There's a clip on YouTube of somebody asking Steve Jobs why they aren't using some sort of like, I think it was like Java or whatever. This is way in the back for their programming stuff. And I'm not a tech guy, so I didn't really fully understand what they were asking. But Steve Jobs' response was, well, you can't build the product to justify the tech. You got to use the right tech that'll build the product that the consumers want, right? So the way that, you know, like these software engineers are thinking about it was, well, we got to show people that we're using the best tech and then make the end product adapt to the tech. Whereas his vision was, no, we have to develop the product based on what the consumers want and what tech is best fitted to make that product, right? In the virtual assistant questions, kind of, I would answer in the same way. It's not like, oh, I need 5 virtual assistants. Okay, now what tasks do I need to give them? But more so it's like, okay, I need to get these tasks done. What virtual assistants do I need to hire to achieve my end goal? The VA question is, it's very, again, subjective, depends on your current situation. If you're just starting out, don't get any VAs. Do everything yourself. It's not worth it because you need to learn the business itself. Having a VA will actually hinder your growth because you're not going to really know what's going on, and therefore you won't be able to teach your VAs as well. You know, I made that mistake in the beginning. I hired way too many and I didn't know what I was doing. So I thought I need all these VAs to help me with my business, but it got way too confusing. And because I didn't know how to build a business myself at that point, I wasn't training them properly and it just didn't end up well. So what I ended up doing was only outsourcing stuff that I actually really didn't want to do and needed to get done. So I kind of trimmed down all the VAs and things really was a lot easier for me after I got rid of all the VAs that I didn't need. You know, so I would say, you know, keep the VA stuff as minimal as possible, enough to get your job done, depending on, you know, what stuff you don't enjoy doing, for example. You can outsource that one by one, but don't think of like VAs being a necessity when you're starting out.
Yeah, because if you don't get hands-on on the business and understand the pieces, it's kind of hard to teach the VAs how to take care of it. And I'm sure you have like SOPs, like standard operating procedures for the VAs, right? Or your assistant now.
He basically knows what he's doing every day now. So it's just, you know, he comes in and just does it. So it's pretty streamlined. It's not, I don't have to make it formal, but yeah, I mean, they know what they're doing. When I was first starting off, so like I went on VA overload. Like I had somebody to go on Upwork for me to hire other people to do certain jobs. And what ended up happening was like, I was basically just adding somebody else I had to manage for a task that I could have just done myself. And it just made things a headache because like they would have to interview people. They would post a job, but I would tell them what to post because they didn't know what they're doing. They would select the people, but talk to them first. But then I would want to talk to them too because I didn't 100% trust their judgment. So I was like, this is stupid. You know, I can just hire these people directly. I don't need to be using somebody to hire for me. And that's when I just started kind of just trimming down, got rid of all like the unnecessary, you know, people that didn't need to pay. And more so than just like the money, it was just like, it made things a lot easier by having less VAs to manage.
Definitely, having remote workers can be sometimes hard to manage. And of course, getting the quality work, you might need to go through a few people before you figure out who is suitable for work. Finally, actually, just before wrapping up this episode, I'm sure there's a lot of people that are on the fence about making the jump, and a lot of it is really internal. So what advice would you give to someone that's really considering making the jump to quit their job, you know, maybe travel and run their own business online?
Sure. So my advice would be, and mine isn't going to be like, I'm not the type of person that like is super like idealistic or whatnot. I'm not going to tell you to, oh, you know, live to your fullest and travel the world so you can see everything. I mean, yeah, that's great. And that's part of the reason why I decided to do it. But if you're really on the fence, if this is something that you're thinking about, you got to get practical, right? So one of the real reasons that I, and this is coming from a practical standpoint, I decided to go into this lifestyle and start my own business was because I wanted to take my own like destiny into my own hands. When you're working at a company, the one of the biggest myths that basically exists is that like jobs are stable. They're not. And you got to understand that, you know, just because you work in a company doesn't mean it's stable. People get laid off all the time. If you're, you know, you would know like a sales job, you're judged on performance. So let's say you have a bad year, you could get fired. And also the thing is that like these companies, they're businesses too. So whether you're running the business or whether a bunch of execs, you know, in suit and ties are running the business and dictating what happens in your company, any business can have its ups and downs. And when it's having its ups and downs, you know, it could be pretty bad, right? And so there really is no such thing as job stability, in my opinion, because there's so many moving parts and you don't really control everything. So what you're doing by working in a job is you're telling your employer, hey, listen, I can't control this on my own. You control it for me. And then I'll just kind of go with the flow. If you decide that the company's doing well and you want to give everybody raises, that's great. But if you decide that stockholder share prices are going down and we got to do some layoffs to increase profits, by all means, I'll just kind of go along with that. I really didn't want that. You know, I didn't want somebody else dictating how I was going to make money and how I was going to live my life. So what I decided was, hey, business is business. I'd rather own my own business. If it doesn't go well, I'll be responsible for it and I'll figure it out. And if things go well, you know, the upside is all mine. You know, if you're working at a company, you know, if things go really well, you have very limited upside. You know what I mean? Unless you're like the CEO or something like that. I thought this doesn't make sense. Why am I taking on all the risk? And, you know, the company's not loyal to any of their employees. If they need to lay off people, they'll lay off people. And you're really the most loyal person to yourself. Right. So by owning my own business, I know that my employer, which is me, is 100% loyal to me and will do whatever it takes in the business to make sure that I'm taken care of. I knew that wasn't the case working in a company. So if you're on the fence, think of it that way. One of the main reasons that anybody would be on the fence and to start in their own business is the job stability stuff. But think of it in a way where, you know, there is no such thing as real job stability. And, you know, it'll make things a lot easier for you to kind of get in, you know, make that transition into the entrepreneurial lifestyle.
A lot of useful insights. So,
yeah, I mean, it's something that I thought about a lot because I used to, before I was in sales, I was in like I used to work in consulting where we had like unbearable hours and the only people that were getting rich were the partners of the company. And I was like, oh, this is bullshit. And that's kind of where, you know, a lot of the thinking came from. You know, came to the realization where, you know, this it doesn't really make sense for me to continue on the path that I was on.
If our audience wants to follow you, where can they find you on the social media? And
sure. So the easiest way to find me would be in my Facebook group. It's called Online Business Secrets. And I think the URL is just basically like Facebook.com/group/online-business-secrets, all one word. And yeah, I'm pretty active in there. I'm actually in the middle of like a 30-day challenge for myself where I'm going live and providing value. Say hello, let me know you found me through Gilbert's podcast, and you know, love to meet you there.
You have a Facebook page or LinkedIn that people can find you as well, or mostly through the Facebook page?
Yeah, they can look me up on LinkedIn. I'm not too active on there. That's basically just for my business itself. And I have a Facebook page. You could look me up, Eric Shim. But I would say the place I'm most active in is the group itself.
Sounds great. So this just about wraps up our episode for today. Thank you, Eric Shim, for coming on to the show. And if you want to find more about the episode, we have a show notes that would be in the description. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Gilbert. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Cheers.
Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. You can find more episodes every Tuesday. If you haven't done so, please subscribe for more updates as they come. Until next time.